Franklin Alex was convicted of murdering a man in Houston, Texas in 1998. Alex is among hundreds of defendants whose DNA evidence was submitted for retesting because of questions of the way it was processed by the Houston Police Department Crime Lab. A probe of this lab was found that an analyst failed to report potentially exculpatory DNA evidence resulting from the slaying cited in the penalty phase of Alex's capital murder trial. You can find more background on this case by referring to our website, www.executionwatch.org, and then forward to the back page on Franklin Alex. I am an ex-convict. I have lost dozens of friends to the death chamber. My activism has included several cases in the United States Supreme Court suing Houston Police Department for its various misbehaviors. I host the prison show. That's my own show. This show is actually produced by Elizabeth Stein. I am merely a voice appearing on this show. But the prison show is now just celebrated last week, its 30th anniversary. You can find out more about that show by going to www.theprisonshow.org. Jim Skelton is on the road between here and San Antonio. He usually joins us for these things, and he has written the extensive material that you will find on executionwatch.org. So we have with us Robert Rosenberg. Robert Rosenberg is a Houston attorney who has represented Franklin Alex since 1998 after his direct appeal was turned down. Welcome to the show, Robert.
Thank you for having me, Ray.
Robert, tell me what you were able to learn about this case in the process of trying to represent Mr. Alex.
I would say, and I've been doing capital habeas work since 1988, I would say Franklin's case is sort of a petri dish for the worst growth of, it's an example of everything in the system that is broken, really, from the illegally conducted autopsy of Eric Bridgeford that should not have been admitted into evidence. It was conducted by Delbert Van Dusen, who worked at the Harris County Medical Examiner's Office and was not licensed by the state of Texas to practice medicine. And he and his boss were sanctioned for practicing medicine without a license. And under the Texas exclusionary rule, the evidence should not have been admitted. To the attorneys who were appointed to represent him, Floyd Freed and Rob Morrow.
Okay, can you hold on just a second, because Robert, because we've got Gloria.
Yeah.
Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, I've got terrible feedback. Okay, tell me what's going on, where you are, and where are you?
Well, I'm in Huntsville, the execution capital of the country here, and there's about, 15 or so people out here, including people from Germany, and a large number of people from Franklin Alex's family. I'm standing here with his cousin, Reginald. Last week we were here, and it was such a joyous occasion, and that so rarely happens, so tonight is another sad occasion. The media went in a couple of minutes before 6, and I guess right when the bells were tolling, the family went in.
Okay, so the witnesses have crossed the road, and that's our tip that the process has begun, and they're going inside. How many of the family are there?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 people. There's also the family inside. There's two brothers, an aunt, and an uncle who is also a minister witnessing the execution. And other brothers are out here. His children are not here.
Franklin's family has been visiting quite a bit in the last week. Actually, since August they have been.
Yeah, I'm having trouble hearing you.
Yeah, well, I'm actually that's Robert commenting that Franklin's family has been visiting regularly for the last few weeks, and so that's been facilitated. Well, I guess what I'll do is return to the studio, discuss some more with Robert. If anything happens up there, we should be aware of. Call Elizabeth either on my phone. She's managed to recoup her phone. Gloria?
Yeah, I lost that call, all that. For some reason, I'm having reception problems here.
Yeah, well, Elizabeth has her phone working now. You can call her on her phone.
Okay.
For another report. Okay?
All right. Bye-bye.
And that was Gloria Ruback, and she is on the scene in Huntsville, where there's a vigil, apparently a large number of people, including folks from Germany. Continue, Robert. I'm sorry about that.
Anyway, he was represented at trial by attorneys M. Floyd Freed and Rob Morrow, who between the time of his arrest and the start of the trial was the original scandal, I guess, or one of the early scandals about the criminal justice system in Houston, which was that there were issues in the medical examiner's office. Mm-hmm. And there were five or six articles that specifically referenced Franklin's case, including comments by the then-sitting DA, Johnny Holmes, who said, well, we're going to have a tough time proving cause of death in that case, because if I was the judge, that autopsy couldn't be admitted because it was illegally obtained evidence.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in the course of representing Franklin, I looked through the files over at the federal building about the whistleblower litigation that some former doctors in the medical examiner's office had filed, and there was an affidavit from one doctor in the medical examiner's office that said that there was actually a meeting between some prosecutors and some of the state court judges on how to go around the law and get these illegal autopsies admitted.
That meeting would have been illegal, too.
It would have been, right? You're right. And why we see the system is broken is that nobody at the courthouse seemed to really be bothered by that. In fact, the Court of Criminal Appeals, in an unpublished opinion, which means it has no precedential value on that particular issue, said that really a medical examiner could appoint anyone, licensed or unlicensed, to conduct autopsies on their behalf. So we could actually be doing autopsies.
Sure. Yeah, me and you.
And I think there was a guy over there behind
the dumpster at the stopping.
Well, now remember years ago the guy who had the saran wrap and wrapped people up and put them in caskets up in his attic.
Maybe that's what was going. No,
the latest fetish. I don't know. Anyway,
now Robert.
Well, at trial,
Robert, let me get some clarification. I'm trying to listen to the audience's way of listening to this. The autopsy that was not properly admitted.
Oh, yes, it was not properly. It was admitted, but it was illegally.
It was not properly admitted. Was that the autopsy that proved the death of the primary victim in this case?
Yes, it did.
So the conviction is based on apparently, if the law were followed, insufficient evidence that a crime had occurred.
That's correct. But even more important than that, because Franklin has always admitted that he shot and killed Eric Bridgeford. Contrary to what people who write comments on the Chronicle website may think,
sure,
Franklin has owned up to his crime from day one.
Okay, was there not a claim that it was some self-defense effort involved?
It wasn't self-defense, but in July of 1997, Franklin's life was pretty much bottomed out in terms of being a successful person, let's say. And he started dealing drugs for a guy. And Franklin, it amazes me that in the Austin American Statesman today, there was an article about Franklin and had a long list of all these crimes that he committed. None of which he left any kind of forensic evidence. He supposedly raped all these women, but there wasn't a speck of DNA. He supposedly did all kind of stuff. But you're talking about a guy who has an IQ in the lower range of, you know, not mentally retarded for legal purposes, but not a bright fellow. who was able to carry out a crime spree, as the Chronicle called it, mm-hmm. for 6 months without leaving any evidence behind.
Well, isn't there some question about the evidence that was left behind?
There is question.
Wasn't that reported to the court as evidence that was inconclusive when, in fact, it was exclusionary?
It was exclusionary, and Christy Kim said it could be inclusionary. She said it did include him. That's the Ramirez shooting, in which Franklin, in August of 97, but let me preface that. You asked me about the other thing, and what happened was Franklin screwed up a drug, you know, being a drug dealer, a low-level drug dealer, and lost or used or something, I don't know, this drug dealer's drugs. So he owed the guy $1,200 and didn't have any money to pay him. So the guy has three guys who also work for him jump Franklin and torch him from head to toe with a propane torch. There was medical evidence. He went to the hospital to be treated, tells the nurse, I was jumped by three guys, and they torched me from head to toe with this propane torch because I owed him money. Well, there were medical records to that effect. Now, his lawyers didn't really make much of that. In Texas, and then the drug dealer said, Franklin, as you can see, I'm serious about getting my $1,200. And if you're not going to pay me, then you're going to be basically my bitch and do whatever I tell you. Or I'm going to kill you and your girlfriend and your baby. So this guy was, you know, running a ring of people who would hijack people in parking lots, put them in the trunk of their car, have people like Franklin, is what he said. His job was to approach the person, put them in the trunk of the car, get their ATM card, and give the code and give it to the drug dealer, who would then drive the car to the bank, withdraw the maximum amount possible, drive back to where Franklin was. Franklin's supposed to let him out of the car, and that guy they wouldn't even know that guy was involved.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's kind of odd. Most of the crimes Franklin supposedly committed were within probably a mile range of where the drug dealer lived. One guy, a doctor, escaped from the trunk of the car when his car was parked in front of the drug dealer's apartment.
Okay.
The way the police found Franklin is they traced a red Toyota to many of these crimes. The red Toyota is owned by the drug dealer's stepmother. So she says, I don't have that car. I gave it to my stepson. So according to the testimony of the detective, he went over and knocked on the drug dealer's apartment door, and the drug dealer says, well, there's some guy, I think his name's Wayman or something, and he lives over there by my cousin. And he left this bag of stuff that might be of interest to you, which happened to contain some stolen property. He says, I don't really know that guy, but, you know, you might look for Wayman.
All of the evidence in this case is pretty shaky stuff.
If you look at it with any kind of critical eye, or in the case of why I say his lawyers were just do-nothings, during their closing argument, they said, as we all know, Kevin Smith, the drug dealer, is behind all this. He's the missing party in this. And he is the key to this. And on about Kevin Smith. And the DA says, oh, don't listen to what they say about Kevin Smith. He had nothing to do with this. The whole closing arguments are focused in the punishment phase on Kevin Smith.
Really?
Well, did the lawyers put on any evidence about Kevin Smith? No. They didn't put on it. Kevin Smith appeared in court and took the fifth outside the presence of the jury, and the DA argued that Kevin Smith was a figment of Franklin's imagination.
Kevin Smith, as the jury is concerned, he didn't exist.
He didn't exist. Kevin Smith's stepmother was sitting there throughout the trial. Why didn't the lawyers point to, you know, his stepmother and say, there's Kevin Smith's stepmother, and it's her car.
All right, Robert, let's shuffle the cards here. Let's suppose that the criminal defense lawyers did not report for duty that day, and you were that lawyer. What would you have done?
Well, the first thing I would have done is I would have read the newspaper before the day the trial started and seen that Johnny Holmes said that autopsy was illegal. And I wouldn't have asked for continuance the day the trial started, claiming I'm totally shocked and surprised when a story that had been a major news story on TV and the newspaper had been going on for 6 months, and their client had been mentioned. They asked for a continuance and said, "We're shocked. We're unprepared. We need a continuance." We had no idea he didn't have a license. Well, not only did he not have a license, but he had been fired from his job immediately before he came to Houston in Atlanta, and the head of the crime of the medical examiner's office in Atlanta, Dr. Speary, told, and her name escapes me right now, but the woman who used to run the crime examiner's office, told her, "Do not hire him. He's a loser." Well, I have her deposition testimony where she said, "I told her not to hire him because he's incompetent."
Well, if all of that was true, and that was raised in the trial?
No. It wasn't raised.
Why wasn't it raised? I mean, they were aware.
You should have invited Mr. Morrow here.
No.
I would love to find out why.
Is that difficult stuff to raise?
No. It isn't difficult stuff to raise. Even Franklin's story is, you know, I participated in the bridge and robbing Carol Bridgeford. I put her in the trunk of the car. Kevin Smith drove her away. What he did when she was in the car with him, I do not know. He brought her back. I let her out of the trunk. She was scared to death. She pleaded with me to not hurt her, that I should go upstairs with her, and she would help me load up all the property from the house in her car, and I could take her car and satisfy Kevin Smith's need for cash.
Okay.
And when we were in the process of doing that, her brother came home from being out partying with a friend of his, and, you know, he ran out of the house, and Franklin ran out of the house, and then Eric turned around, charged at Franklin. Franklin had a gun. He started to fall backwards. The gun discharged, shot Eric, and killed him. That's Franklin's story.
How many of these cases have you dealt with?
About 6 or 7 or 8. I don't know.
Are they all screwed up?
They are all screwed up. It's not. Franklin's case is special in the way that it is. Maybe they're not all as screwed up as Franklin's, but Franklin's is special in the way that you have a complicit newspaper, the only newspaper in town, who, when the DNA story broke, at some point, some level of the people at the Chronicle, and I don't think it was Steve or Roma, decided that they would not implicate anyone in the DA's office for wrongdoing. You have judges who sat there and let the craziest evidence come in without questioning it. You have lawyers who do nothing.
Who was the judge in this case?
George Godwin.
George Godwin. God.
You have a court of criminal appeals who, after George Godwin did say about, I don't know, I forget what year, but after the case had been pending on habeas for a long time and the DNA stuff came out, he entered an order that says that it appears that Franklin's rights were violated regarding the DNA and that he thought he needed a new sentencing trial. And it had to go to the court of criminal appeals for approval. They entered an order telling him to hold a full and fair hearing to fully explore this DNA issue. He refused to do it. And after about a year and a half or something of me trying to get it done, he held another hearing, and the DA showed up with a DNA report from Adenogene that contradicted their previous DNA report. The first DNA report they did unequivocally excluded Franklin as a contributor.
Mm-hmm.
The second one, which I objected to, and that it was improper to even consider it because they had no one to cross-examine on it, so they equivocated on their position that Franklin might have been a contributor. Well, in the meantime, what had happened was the Bromwich report came out, which said not only was Franklin not a contributor, but that prior to his trial, the HPD crime lab had tested the DNA and had excluded him as a contributor. Well, under the DA's own theory of how Mr. Ramirez was killed, whoever was wearing the gauze is who killed killed Mr. Ramirez, and it wasn't Franklin. Because Mr. Ramirez's blood was on the gauze.
Mr. Ramirez is one of the ancillary homicides.
Yes, one of the extraneous offenses. The first in this long stream of crime that Franklin supposedly committed. Or, you know, the most significant of the early crimes. And I'll take a little bit of exception as to what you said about Mr. Ramirez's death and when it was used at the trial. It wasn't just used at the punishment phase. What happened at the trial was during the guilt and innocence phase, the defense put Franklin on to testify about how he'd been tortured and hurt by Mr. Smith, mm-hmm. and how this was an accident.
And that opened the window.
Well, it didn't open the window, but the DA got Franklin to say, and before this, I'd never hurt anybody in these crimes. And the DA jumped on that and said, yes, you have. You shot and killed Mr. Ramirez, didn't you? And he said, no, I didn't. And then they called Mr. Ramirez's wife, who testified that although on the night her husband was shot and killed, she wasn't able to describe the shooter because he was wearing a mask. She was able to pick him up out later from a video lineup that the detective showed him after they covered up Franklin's face with a piece of paper so it looked like he had a mask on.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And why I say this case is so preposterous and encompasses how horrible the system is, no one, not Franklin's defense lawyers, not the judge, and not the jury, said, wait a minute, how could she pick him out if his face was covered in a lineup?
Okay. Excuse me, we got a report from Huntsville now. Hello, Gloria. Gloria.
Yes.
This is Ray. You're on the air.
Oh, okay. I was on the microphone.
Yes, I can tell. I heard you on the microphone this morning on BBC World Report.
Oh, yeah, I missed that. I wasn't up in time.
Oh, well, you made it to the station on time to do your open journal piece.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, well, it
the
was only...
The family's walking out. The reporters came out first, and there's a large group of his family and spiritual advisors and gray shirts coming out.
So we can logically assume that the process completed. Franklin Alex has been executed.
He has. His funeral will be in Houston at the Greater St. Matthew Church off of MLK this weekend.
Greater St.
Do you know what day and time?
Huh?
Do you know?
We'll announce that on the radio.
I can find out.
Yeah, well, we need to get that, at least get it on the website.
Okay.
Okay.
Let me ask his aunt. You know when the funeral is?
Saturday.
And the name of the church? Matthew. Greater St. Matthew Church and funeral on Jutland. And the funeral is Saturday.
Okay. On Saturday, call the Greater St. Matthew Church.
Right.
And
Jones High School.
Okay.
By MLK.
Okay. Do you have any family members who want to talk on the
show? Yeah. Reginald, please give the family my condolences. Would you like to say a few words to people in Houston on the radio? Okay, Ray, this is Reginald, Franklin's cousin.
Okay. Reginald?
How you doing?
I am. Well, we're doing a radio show. I'm sorry you're going through what you're going through. Would you like to tell us some observations of today?
It was just a little different, you know, after kind of seeing stuff like this on TV is really pretty much nothing like that, with the whole process of even Franklin not knowing his exact date to not too long ago, you know, when you know all your appeals are exhausted, you know, they kind of have you waiting. It's just kind of cruel, you know, but in a situation like this, is, you know, sometimes it's a win-win, it's a win-loss. This is definitely a lose-lose situation, you know. We've lost, the families that were involved lost, so, you know. Just one of those days, you know.
Did you witness the execution?
I didn't. I've been on the outside trying to, you know, keep some other family members pretty strong. Right. He had two brothers in, uncle of ours, an aunt, and another cousin. And he also had another little brother that was on the outside out here. So I was just with him and some more cousins and some more aunts.
Is the family or some of them making the journey to Huntsville Funeral Home?
Yes, we will. I believe pretty much all of us are going to go that way.
Okay, well, then I will bid you farewell and let you do that. Sorry to have to report this on the radio tonight. My best to the family.
Thank you, and thank you for all the people out there that's praying for us. And like I said, the victim too, because like I said, there's just no winners in this situation. You know, may God continue to bless us and bless his family too, and y'all guys keep doing the things that you're doing and bring awareness to this type of, you know, criminal activity that's going on in the state of Texas.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
And that was
his cousin.
Reginald, his cousin, giving us a report. Robert, do you get to know the family over the process?
I have gotten to know his aunt a little bit. I have spent a long time with Franklin, and would find him to be a very pleasant, thoughtful person when I would visit him. He did have a tendency to write me very nasty letters between visits, thinking that I had forgotten his existence and wasn't doing anything for him.
But I
didn't take it personally.
Yeah, that's within standard routine.
If you don't want those letters, then you don't do this work.
By the way, if you're listening to this and you're going to ultimately wind up in prison sometime, and you're going to be trying to get loving attention from your attorney, just because your attorney, he or she's not there, doesn't mean they're not on the case.
Exactly. And I find often just showing up heals all wounds and broken hearts.
Yeah. Whether it has anything to do with anything.
Didn't have anything to do with me. Franklin has always been remorseful. Again, contrary to what the DA may have said and what people may write in who've never met or spoken to him. And one of the things that he expressed to me after I sort of let him know in August that I was in Texas. I wasn't living in Texas at the time. I came to Texas to visit him. And
Nancy?
Yeah, hi, Ray.
Hi, darling. We're sad to report that Mr. Alex, Franklin Alex, has been executed. The process in Huntsville is complete. Where are you?
Hard to hear that.
Where are you, darling?
On the corner of Westheimer and Shepherd in front of St. Anne's Catholic Church.
And how many folks are with you?
We had 7 people all today. It's breaking up right now.
Okay.
But there were 7 people standing on both sides of the corner holding signs so that traffic could be seen, see our signs coming from 2 directions. We got lots of friendly waves, not very many bad remarks, but mostly friendly waves and thumbs up.
Well, thank you very much for Nancy. We're sorry to report that the process has been completed.
Well, thanks for keeping up with it, Ray, and doing what you're doing.
And give our regards to the other vigilants as you see them.
I sure will.
Thank you, ma'am.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And that was Nancy Bailey, and Nancy is with Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, and they have a website with the acronym of that, Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. There are vigils tonight in Huntsville where the death chamber is, here in Houston, in San Antonio, in Austin, in Harlingen, and in Brownsville, mostly around Catholic churches, except the one in Austin is very secular, and the one in Huntsville is simply because that's where the action is taking place. That happens every time there's an execution. And every time there's an execution, Elizabeth Stein produces this show and allows me to come host. I've been talking tonight with Robert Rosenberg, our usual legal analyst. Jim Skelton is not here. He's on the road somewhere between here and San Antonio, probably within listening range, but if his car doesn't have an HD2 radio, that's to no avail. You're listening on radio station KPFT Houston, HD2 channel, and of course you're listening internationally on the web at executionwatch.org. I'm Ray Hill, and I'm the usual host. We are able to do this because of the wizardry of Otis McClay, who's in there twisting transistors and wires together to make that happen. I'm going to take a few minutes away from Robert here and discuss with Steve McVicker. Steve?
Yes, Ray.
Good to hear you. For a little known, Steve McVicker is a former news director of radio station KPFT and was actually news director part of the time when I was general manager, and we managed to get along even then.
Yes. I can't say the station was all the better part, but we got along.
Tell me, Steve, how did you discover this case in your story?
Well, Alex came up in our case because we had been looking at the DNA evidence that came out of the crime lab, and we got to thinking that, well, DNA evidence had only been, they only began using that in the very late 80s, early 90s, and it was sporadic at best then. And what they had used before that was serology. And the same people that were doing the DNA had also done the serology. So it only stood to reason in our minds was that if they didn't know what the hell they were doing DNA, maybe they didn't know what they were doing in serology either. And so we started going back and looking at, we went back and looked at every case involving serology back to about 1980. From late, I guess from 89 back to 80, maybe some of the late 70s, we went and held up Roma Khanna, my partner, and got ourselves sequestered in the bowels of the state Supreme Court building where all the death row records are kept, and it just went through those paper files one by one looking for anything that struck us as hinky, and this was one of the cases that popped out.
Well, that's, I have to explain to the audience, the term hinky is a police term, meaning something that looks out of the ordinary.
Can I ask a question?
Just right. Something that looks out of the ordinary, is that correct? Is that what hinky means?
Yes.
Okay. What is your impression, Robert? Rosenberg's in the studio with us, and I'm going to turn his microphone back on. Robert has a question.
Are you and Roma the ones that brought up Franklin's name, or before the DA's office had filed the motion to release the DNA to be retested?
I don't know at what point the DA's office filed their motion. I know we had him in some of our stories, and including that serology piece that was... I don't know exactly when we looked. I think I have a story here that might give us a date.
I think my recollection is y'all contacted me in response to the DA's filing of the pleading to release the DNA.
I don't know. You could be right, Robert. It all sort of runs together at this point.
Well, Steve, tell me, going back to that era, how many articles did you and Roma produce? Well, actually, you started writing about this before you went to the Chronicle.
A little bit, but we started writing about it full bore at the Chronicle. And Roma and I were teamed up from the beginning, starting in February of 2003,
but you had actually written some articles about this lab for the Houston Press before you moved to the Chronicle.
A little bit, not that much.
Okay. Now, how many articles do you think were produced over this subject?
God, I've never sat down and counted them.
50?
200, 300, something.
300, 200? Over what period of time?
From 93 till about 96.
2003 to 2006.
Yeah, 2003 to 96.
Yeah, we lost a decade there.
Yeah, sorry.
And in this process, What's your overall impression? Do you think that people in the lab were just so incompetent that they didn't do the work, or do you think that they were being motivated by police officers and DAs saying, I want you to find?
I think they were incompetent, and I think they went out of their way to replicate the findings that the police officers already had come up with. If the police already had a strong suspect, they would make sure that their findings matched those of the police officers. Now, that said, I'm not so sure that the police officers were necessarily doing the same thing, that they were gearing their findings towards what the lab was coming up with. I think the lab was intent on backing up the department, but I honestly think the department, the lab did a horrible job, but I think the reason you don't see more bad cases is that the HPD Homicide Division actually did a pretty good job.
But you know, one of the things that I find all too frequently, as a matter of fact, I'm composing a letter to City Council right now saying the city attorney is actually suborning perjury to introduce in a civil case testimony of vice officers who so consistently lie under oath that I don't believe there's any credible evidence that they've ever told the truth.
You're talking vice versus homicide.
Yeah, homicide. But all cops. You know, I think every wrongful conviction on the planet, and I'm not saying this was a wrongful conviction, but every wrongful conviction on the planet begins when one cop turns to another and says, I got a hunch about this case. And then immediately, all search for the truth stops and it moves forward to prove that hunch.
To some extent, I'm not going to say that that was extremely widespread. It may have been so, it was more so at some point in the department, but, I hate to, like I'm kissing the ass of the department, but I think the homicide guys, I think, do a pretty good job. The crime here was that that these unqualified people were allowed to do these tests, and that these unqualified people turned their tests to match the homicide guys' findings.
Well, and do you think that the situation is any different now?
Since my departure from the Chronicle, I really haven't had much access to what's happening at the crime lab, so I couldn't tell you.
Well, do you think the situation is common to other crime labs as well as to Houston?
I just heard of one. There's a situation going on right now, almost identical to this in San Francisco right now. I think it's going to be popping up all over the nation. And Houston wasn't the first place that this went wrong.
And were you able to discover any culprits?
The main culprit in all this was former crime lab chief Don Boldy. Don had no business running that lab, and Don did some very shady things while he was in the lab. Unfortunately, as our recently departed district attorney Chuck Rosenthal used to like to say, that the statute of limitations had run out and there was nothing they could do against Mr. Boldy, whether they wanted to or not, and I'm not sure they wanted to.
Was it your impression that some of Mr. Boulding's incompetence or abuses were actually criminal in nature?
I believe so. And the other thing, while I don't believe that HPD was in there pushing crime lab investigators to replicate their findings, I have a very strong feeling that that was not the case with the district attorney's office. I think the district attorney's office, I think there's some people in the district attorney's office that needed to go to jail over this.
And as I recall, when the stuff hit the fan, the only party that really was accessible was former police chief CEO,
Bill Bradford.
Yeah. He kept on holding news conferences. I remember going to them and seeing you and Roman there gnawing on him.
Well, I mean, we just found early on in the investigation, it was one of the first things I found. I got hold of some documents out of Austin that showed that Chief Bradford knew early on as chief that the conditions in the lab were substandard and that evidence was being destroyed, and he did nothing about it. And then he held a press conference to say, no, that's not the case. The Chronicle's got it all wrong. And the very next afternoon, I found even more documents and actual witnesses who would speak this time that said, oh, yeah, he did. And
yeah, but he never actually hid from the press until the end of his term. But Rosenthal...
He took an early retirement.
Yeah, but Rosenthal was behind the receptionist who was simply not available. Yeah. And, well, do you have any other overall comments before I move on toward the end of the show?
I think there's, if there was somebody that was doing investigative work in this town, I would think that there is still a lot of stuff to look at over there. That's not something that the Chronicle wanted to hear anymore, but I think there's still a lot of stuff over there that is yet to be discovered.
And you're talking about journalism, which is a dying art.
You got it.
Thank you, Steve. How's the movie?
Last hour, it was supposed to be released April 30th. I heard yesterday sometime in August. So I'll know when you know.
Yeah, well, please let me know when you find out.
Okay.
Okay. Bye-bye. Bye. Steve McVicker has written a book, I Love You, Philip Morris, which has been turned into a Jim Carrey movie. And that movie is about to open up soon. It's already been premiered in Hollywood. We weren't fortunate enough to get it here, although it is a Houston gay convict story.
And Steve is in it as a judge.
Yes, Steve shows up as the judge. Speaking of the judge, we're back with Robert. Robert, you listened to all of this conversation.
It was very difficult to listen to that conversation.
Well,
without being allowed to speak.
You know, you're driving me crazy. Yeah, one of the things we do around here is we try to do a friendly program, and we didn't want y'all getting into a cat fight on the air.
I wasn't going to get in a cat fight with him, but I did want
to get a little closer
to
the microphone this week.
I did want to ask him if he believed that, well, first of all, I have a hard time accepting that the people in the crime lab, the lowest paid in the food chain, were doing these things on their own, without some guidance, encouragement.
I did ask that question.
And I was stunned by his answer.
Well, what is your answer to that question?
Well, my answer might be answered best by some of the prosecutor's notes that I found that came up when I filed grievances against the prosecutors mm-hmm. in this case. And they had discussed with Christy Kim the long-suppressed DNA evidence that exculpated Franklin mm-hmm. during her pre-trial interview. So, where she actually had testified that she did not do that testing.
But she had a conversation with the DA before, so she was woodshedded to respond.
You know, that's what I found curious. Because she actually, not only did she give false testimony about the results she got, she gave false testimony about the test she conducted. And she explained why it is she did not conduct the most precise test available at that time, because she said the samples were not good enough to do that test. Well, that was the test that had been suppressed.
Mm-hmm.
So, to me, what I say is that this case represents about how broken the system is. Why was that not of interest to the judge when it came out? When it came out that this test had been suppressed for, I don't remember what year it came out, that it, whenever the Bromwich Report came out, probably in 2006, 2007, why it is that we've been screwing around in Judge Godwin's court for 3 years, mm-hmm. and I've been asking for all the documents, and they had not given me this suppressed test, why he didn't scream and yell at them and send them to jail or fine them or report them to the state bar is his duty. And instead, they had wasted his time, my time, taxpayer money, and he had no words to say about it. In fact, he and the DA, because I would not go to hearings in his office without a court reporter,
mm-hmm.
I said, all of our hearings are going to be in open court on the record.
Sure.
Well, you say sure, but that isn't what happened.
But that's the way it should be.
I mean, it is the way it should be, right. But I was the one who insisted sure. on it.
But you and I am even more free agent than you are. You are an attorney. You've got a bar card. That uh-huh. puts you in a box of some kind.
But you get more comfortable.
One of the great blessings of my life is that I'm not an officer of the court. I'm not officer of the court, so I'm not in any box. But if you're the reporter for the major newspaper, you've not only got to tell the story, but you've got to tell the story within the constraints placed on you by
the
editors.
Well, you know what, Ray?
Yes.
You have to show up in court for the hearings if you're going to tell the story about them. And as much as I might admire Steve and Roma for the work they did do,
mm-hmm.
they often did not show up for the hearings. And what they would have seen is the judge and the DA would let me go on and on and on. And they would go, uh-huh, okay, are you done? And that would be all they'd say.
Mm-hmm.
Because they didn't want to create a record, because they didn't have anything to say. At one point, the DA says, well, you know, after all these years, we found some hair.
Would that have happened if, say, the judge had been Myron Love?
I don't know. I think there were old judges, and, you know, when I first started practicing, when I was in law school, I went and watched Racehorse Haynes try the case with Cullen Davis.
Mm-hmm.
And I forgot the judge, but he used to sit there and smoke like a chimney.
Yeah.
And he ran the court in a much different way
than
anybody runs the court today.
Right.
Right now, the DAs are picked by the judges are picked by the DA.
Sure.
It's been that way since Johnny Holmes took over.
Uh-huh.
And it's an extension of the DA's office. Mm-hmm. The judges are now. I hadn't been in town for the new judges.
Well, we're beginning to make some inroads in that. But you're making the same observation that I make when I'm out making political stump speeches.
Right when the morning starts at the courthouse.
Yeah.
And the judge and the DA come out from the judge's office
before anybody,
and they've already worked everything out about what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And then you kind of know how the rest of the day is going to go.
Sure.
And at one point, I got a little bit suspicious about the discussions they were having. So I wrote Roe Wilson's office a letter that I said something unpleasant about the judge. I said, you need to quit having these ex parte communications.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow or other, the judge knew that I had written her the letter.
Shock, shock, shock.
And was indignant that I had suggested they had ex parte communication, not even realizing that him raising it suggested that that's what they'd had.
See, one of the things is that not being an officer of the court, I've actually witnessed some of it. I've gone beyond that. I walked back into the courtroom after winning a pro se case by myself and gone back in there and listened to the judge training the witness on
Absolutely.
How to testify in the next case so that
it doesn't happen again.
Right, so that the record.
Well, Ray, I think that
thing you and I both asked for is a record.
Which is unusual. What I found out in Franklin's case is when I would send them pleadings and I'd send an extra copy to get file stamped with a self-addressed stamped envelope so it could be returned, and it never got returned. I came into town and I went down there and I said, I'd like to file this. And they tell me, well, Roe Wilson said that it needs to be assigned a new number so that it's a successor writ. And I said, well, why are you asking Roe Wilson for instructions at the clerk's office on how to file documents?
Right.
And he says, well, let me talk to my supervisor. So he walks away for 30 minutes, and I'm sure they called Roe, and comes back and says, okay, well, we're going to put the number you assigned to it, you know, that it's supposed to have. I said, okay, and I'd like a file stamped copy, and I'd like a copy of the docket sheet after you enter it. Because I found out you don't enter any of my pleadings on the docket sheet. in a habeas case.
Robert,
they don't keep a docket sheet in a habeas case, and then when you go to federal court, the Attorney General's office says, wait a minute, Mr. Rosenberg didn't do anything in state court. There's no evidence that he filed anything or he had any hearings. So I said, well, Judge, I'd like to know what you're putting on the docket sheet today. Could you read back the entry?
Mm-hmm.
And I object to the fact that my pleadings are not entered on the docket sheet.
How can you practice law under these circumstances?
How do you practice law
in these
circumstances?
Law under these circumstances?
I guess the same way you do. You practice law in these circumstances, right?
I do my stuff on the street.
Well,
and
you still,
the ballot
you still
box.
Hang out in the same circles,
right.
And you still bang your head against the same walls.
Well, I just happen to have a great love for bad coffee.
Well, I don't know, but I can tell you this. What makes it especially difficult is to pick up the Chronicle and see the garbage that's in the Chronicle and how they report things and misreport things. You know, I handled a case for Howard Guidry,
mm-hmm.
where his conviction was thrown out.
Mm-hmm.
Based on a lying police officer, three lying police officers. I spoke to the reporter who wasn't Steve or Roma for hours. He talked to me about the guy, hours and hours. And the article that was published, the first article they published after it was thrown out, was the case was overturned, the conviction was overturned because of hearsay evidence. Was hearsay testimony was admitted.
Testimony.
I called up Harvey Rice. I called up Harvey. I said, Harvey, I know that in the article you wrote.
Right.
He said, you're right.
Right.
I said, Harvey, how many cases do you think would be reversed on admitting hearsay testimony in Houston, Texas? Not a one.
Yeah.
I said, the reason, and it's in the court's opinion, so it's not my opinion, it's the judge's opinion.
Sure.
Is because the police officers lied at the trial. They lied after the trial, and then they came into federal court and they lied. And that's what Judge Gilmore said.
Mm-hmm.
So it isn't Robert Rosenberg saying it. It's not Robert Rosenberg saying that the DA suppressed the DNA evidence in Franklin's case. It was Michael Bromwich, who the city paid $6 million for.
Sure.
His opinion. And Michael Bromwich is a liar. You know, Steve and Roma wrote a very lengthy story that I gave them about ballistics,
mm-hmm.
and the Johnny Bernal case and the Nan Williams case. And I spoon-fed that article to them. And I also gave it to Channel 13. Well, actually, before any of the Crime Lab stuff blew up, the Houston Press had published an article about the same case and the phony ballistics testimony.
Sure. I remember that article.
Okay. Well,
we were talking about Nan and Williams on KPFT this morning. He's
okay.
got a hearing coming up this week.
Well, that's great, and I wish Johnny could get out of jail, but unfortunately, he's not going to get out of jail.
Johnny Bernal.
Right. And, you know, it's his attorney. So, anyway, I got a call from Channel 13 did a story on Friday, and their story is coming out on Sunday, and they call me up, and they are so pissed at me, the editor, because I gave Channel 13 a jump on the story. I said, what are you talking about? I gave the story to Mike Tolson at the Chronicle 3 years ago.
Yeah.
And he said I didn't give him enough information, that I needed to find other cases of ballistics tampering. And then he might write a story about
sure.
it. I said, that's not my job. I'm
no,
just
no,
a defense
no.
lawyer.
What do you think of my theory that every wrongful conviction begins when one cop turns to another and says, I got a hunch about this case?
Absolutely. And, you know,
and that
it doesn't even begin now. Now it begins when Nancy Grace learns the name of the person. You know, now it begins if, you know, a pretty white girl is missing and she happens to know another man.
Right.
You know, and God forbid you should know some woman who's disappeared that, you know.
Knows a man.
That is pretty, and then Nancy's going to talk about you and convict you. But I can tell you, you know, they didn't attend hearings. Chuck Rosenthal and Bradford, after the ballistics stuff came out,
mm-hmm.
in two big articles, there was a press conference down at City Hall, and Chuck Rosenthal was standing there saying, well, you know, we don't have any issues in any other field except for the DNA. You know, our ballistics is fine. And I was sitting next to Roman. I said, well, aren't you going to ask him about the article you just had published? And, no, I can't. I'm not going to. I said, why don't you challenge him? That's your job, isn't it?
No.
They didn't want to touch the DA. Now he's willing to throw, you know, a little bit of the DNA, DA's.
Oh, they didn't get him on wrongful convictions. They got him on emails.
Who?
Rosenthal.
And you know who got Bradford? We had a press conference over at Shape.
Yeah.
Do you remember that one on Nannan Williams and Johnny Bernal?
Yeah.
And it was a slow news weekend. Yeah. And I said, I don't understand why Bradford is still in office. He's been purposefully ignorant on all this stuff. You know, everybody knows he's lying. And they played it on the news over and over all weekend. And within a week, he, you know, decided to leave. But until then, the Chronicle wasn't calling for his resignation.
No.
And the Chronicle wasn't asking Chuck Rosenthal why you're lying.
Okay, Robert, I've got just about 2 minutes here, and I did want to ask
you. Oh, I'm sorry you got me started.
Want to ask you a question.
Really?
Did you know that in the city of Houston, 24 times in the last 18 months, a police officer pulled his gun and someone tried to run over him with a car?
Mm-hmm.
That happens more frequently in Houston than anywhere else on the planet. I don't know of any other jurisdiction where every time a police officer pulls a gun, someone tries to run over the car, and he has to shoot them through the side or the rear window.
Well, you know, Ray, that happened when I was living in South Florida a few years ago. A 15-year-old kid was at a high school party and got murdered that way.
I've got to close. Thank you for listening to Execution Watch. I am Ray Hill. Our guest tonight, who is wonderfully full of information, is Robert Rosenberg. Our producer is Elizabeth Stein. We couldn't do any of this without the wizardry of Otis McClay. And Steve McVicker was a guest, and we had reports from both Huntsville and the Vigil in Houston. Good night.